So many people think that their first tests as being strong Jews when they leave yeshiva is going to be, you know, when that girl tries to hug you, or when you are in a questionable kashrut situation, and those probably are true. But my guess is that for many of us, the first challenge as strong Jews is going to be in some sort of financial situation, whether it's working in summer camp or internships or other kinds of situations. Right, the world of halacha relating to responsibility to our fellow Jews is vast, and unfortunately most of us, including myself, are ignorant about that realm. Baruch Hashem, we've always benefited from Dr. Kallis' presence in the Beit Midrash, who for myself is a real model of someone who integrates the world of professionalism and career with being a genuine and constantly striving Ben Torah. And it's really a real zechut and a privilege to hear the words he's going to share with us today, based on his experience and his halakhic knowledge, as to what it takes to be a strong Jew in the workplace. Just to give you a sense of what's going to happen, Dr. Kallis will speak for about 20 minutes or so to give us an overview of some of the issues involved, and then we have a panel discussion with some other business people about how things play out in the world.
Hey, thank you all for coming. I'd like to really, you know, I don't want to just talk about the business world, and I want to give sort of a framework of what the Torah's model is for sort of how a Jew is supposed to conduct his life, obviously with business, and with Torah. And to get to that point, I'd like to learn together with you a Mishnah. The Mishnah and this is the Mishnah with the Perush of Rabbeinu Yonah. The Mishnah is in the second parak of Avos. The Mishnah says, Rabban Gamliel, Binosha Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. So this is after the time of the Chibra Mishnah, right? It's the son. It's the son of Rabbi. Right? He says, Yafe Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. It says, Talmud Torah is nice with Derech Eretz. She Giyas Shneya Mishkachas Avon. So what's Derech Eretz? What's Derech Eretz? Way of the world. Right? So Derech Eretz is a very ambiguous word. In Shas, it comes up in many different patterns. It can mean manners. It can mean the relations between a husband and wife. The Rabbeinu Yonah here says, Ritzono lomar mulacha. It means work. Mulacha. Labor. Okay? Ki lashon derech eretz. Because derech eretz in general, pa'amim shu kimashmo, sometimes it's derech eretz. To be one with the way of the world. Again, to be to shtim with people, to work with people. In fact, the Meiri brings down the Derech Eretz here also means having good manners, because he says it's nice to have good manners together with Derech Eretz, because when you don't, there's nothing as incongruous as a person who has a vast amount of Torah knowledge, but his midos are terrible. He's angry, he's rude, etc. So he goes with that, but Rabbeinu Yonah insists that over here the pshat is malacha. Okay, lashon derech eretz pa'amim shehu kimashmao u'pa'amim shehu amar l'malacha va'akol l'fia inyan, and everything goes according to its context. And he says here contextually, it clearly means work. And the reason he says that, because it goes on, shnehem mishkachas avon, and then it says kol Torah she'eni ma'malacha, Torah without malacha sofa batala v'goreres avon. And if you try to have Torah without work, you're gonna. It's impossible. There's no escape from ending up on a path of sin. I like to explain it like this. Really, a person can't be a decent person without having something that keeps him busy. Okay, and why is that? Imagine you're going to the you know, there's different areas in New York. You go into an area in New York full of garages. Yeah, somewhat seedy areas, but during the day you see people there, they're working on the cars. And when you pass by some of the people who work there, they're pretty scary looking fellows. They have tattoos and this and that, and they're big, and they're working on cars, you know, this is a kind of environment. You could pass by there and you could dress in the most honest way. You could dress, you know, put on a big hat and a long jacket with a big beard. They're not going to pay any attention to you at all. And why is that? The answer is because they're busy. And when they're busy and they're engrossed in their work, and labor has that property, labor and work have the property of engrossing you and keeping you completely completely involved with the labor at hand. But go to that same neighborhood at night, should those guys not be busy, and they're sitting on a stoop outside, you might be in trouble if you stand out. They may call out something to you. It might be a less than pleasant experience. What's the difference? At one point they were very, very busy, and now they're not busy. Let me give you an example from halacha about the importance of keeping yourself busy. Okay? There are people out there who breed animals. Okay? And sometimes the malacha of breeding animals is such where a person, you're not allowed, the halacha says you're not allowed to look at an animal while they're breeding because it can bring on hirhurim. But you can, if you're an animal breeder, it's fully mutter to go ahead and do whatever it takes to be involved with that maisa of breeding. And we don't have to go to the animal kingdom for that. How is there a heter for a man to be an OBGYN? How is there a heter? So you look at the tshuvas, the darche tshuva, they bring down tshuvas about men checking women, and there's a famous tshuva from the Binyan Sion who was asked, is it mutter for me to, who was a doctor, the person was asking, is it mutter for me to deliver my sister-in-law's child, Eishes Ach? After all, she's an Arayis. So he said, well, if that's a question, why don't you ask that shayla on every single Eishes Ish, every single married woman who's having a baby, you should have the same shayla. Ella what? A person who's involved with his work is so engrossed in his work, he doesn't think about other things. Now, this is a tremendous thing. You spend the whole year in yeshiva learning about how terrible the Yetzer Hara is. And everyone's telling you, about the misyonos you have in the world, and don't go to this website, and make sure you filter your internet, this and that. And here you have a job, two jobs I just brought examples of, where it's mutter for you to spend your entire day involved in a arayus, in some degree. What's the pshat? It shows you the great koach. It's a tremendous koach to work. That work has to cancel out the Yetzer Hara. Work has a tremendous koach. Now, obviously you say, what about all the problems that happen at work? You hear about these horror stories. We're having a whole panel about the problems at work. Well, the answer is, sometimes at work you're not busy. But a person's tachid in life, and this is what the mission is telling you, is that person has to be busy. Okay? Because when there's no such thing as a vacuum. You're supposed to be busy with work, or you're supposed to be busy with learning, and for anything else, okay, that's an invitation for the Yetzer Hara. Let me show you how the Rebbein Yonah describes it. The Rebbein Yonah says, "Shigiyas shnei mishkachas avon." Okay, toiling in both Torah and in work, mishkachas avon makes you forget sin. Right, the same person who, in a different context, would have Yetzer Hara. Now he's a doctor. He forgot the sin. He's just focused on the melacha at hand. Meisir, so he says, Kolomar, it's Meisir Yetzer Hara Milibo. Kimo Shenemar, he quotes a pasuk from Tehillim, Hein Ba'avon Chalalti. David HaMelech is saying that I was formed in sin. Okay? Meaning, we know, the Yetzer Hara has a head start in us in life. Right? We only get a Yetzer Tov at our bar mitzvah. But from the very beginning of when we're born, we're formed in sin. The Yetzer Hara is part and parcel of what we do. Now, the Yetzer Hara could be a tremendous benefit to us as well. Okay, gives us drive. Okay, if we didn't have a Yetzer Hara, we may never eat. We'll die of starvation. You know, we wouldn't reproduce if we didn't have a Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara has a tremendous amount of benefits, but you have to realize the Yetzer Hara is there from the beginning. David HaMelech here is saying that the Yetzer Hara is part and parcel of who we are. So the Mishnah here is saying Shayideshu Yageya Batora Ubin Malacha Lo Yishlov Alav Hayetzer. Because you're involved in both things, the Yetzer Hara will not consume you. Okay, ki b'chol eis. This is a profound statement. He says, "Asher lo yedashen v'shamein." When a person is not in a mode where he is chilled out, if a person is constantly just wants to get pleasure and he wants the next fun thing to come along and he's waiting for that thing, that's called being dashen v'shamein. Okay, when he's not in that way, when a person is more focused on a task at hand, lo ya'arev lo la'asos averos. A person will not be a rave to him, it won't be tasty to him to have sin, because he's busy. He's not in a mode of chilling out. He's not in a mode of relaxation. That's when you have to worry about Yetzer Hara. But a person who's busy, okay, is a person who's not going to want to sin. Lachain yasok batora. So how do you curb the Yetzer Hara? This is the solution for curbing the Yetzer Hara. Lachain, on one hand you have the Torah, which is mateshes kochel shel adam, that weakens your Yetzer Hara. The koach he's referring to here is not talking about your koach. You can still probably press the same amount. It's the same thing. You have the same muscles, whether you learn Torah or you don't learn Torah. But the point is, the koach he's talking about here, Torah mateshes kochel shel adam, is that it weakens your Yetzer Hara for sin. The koach of Yetzer Hara is mitigated. Okay, the gam b'mlachto. And what's the other side? The other side is you have your Torah that weakens, and the second part of the solution is you have your work that weakens your Yetzirah. The lo yamod batal olam. And the goal in life is to never, ever be batal. Never be batal. That's the secret. If you're worrying about, you know, how am I going to survive all the nisyonos that are going to come up in the next couple of months, so you should know that if you're involved in work, okay, and you're really working in work, and you're amel in work, that means you're giving your boss an honest amount of your effort, putting in 100%, okay, and you get totally absorbed. You see how people get absorbed in their work, and sometimes they go a little too far. Sometimes people go a little too far in that. But to understand that this is what Chazal is telling you, a person must always be busy. A person always has to be busy. He goes on that the biggest threat is pen yis anegba, a person who tries to have oneg in this world. He's going to come to a situation of ram levavo, his lev will get haughty, v'shachach es Hashem elokav, he's going to forget Hashem. So work doesn't make you forget Hashem, learning doesn't make you forget Hashem, it's batala that makes you forget Hashem. K'nin sh'nemar v'yishman yishurun v'yivad, when did Klal Yisrael become corrupt? When things go very well, when we're doing well financially, we don't have stresses, then we find time in our hearts, we find time in our minds to find oneg and pleasure in life. I'll just share with you an idea I saw in the Haggadah of Rav Shinshin David Pincus, which I thought was a phenomenal, phenomenal thought. He says, he quotes that, if you remember, in Parshas Vayishlach, there's a fight between Yaakov and his angel. Okay, and at the end of the fight, Yaakov says, I apologize to the Shana Beck guys who were here, heard this, I said this last week, same chat. But at the end of the fight, he says, what's your name? Tell me what your name is. That's what Yaakov said. And the angel answers back to him, Lama zatisha al shmi? Why do you need to know my name? And Rashi says, why do you ask my name? Right? After all, this is what the Malach is saying. Our name changes with whatever tafkid we have. So Rav Shinshin Pinchas says a profound point. Rav Shinshin Pinchas says that when Yaakov is asking, what's your name? He goes, I want to know your name. What form are you? And this is, he's arguing that, he's saying that this is the Yitzhara that Yaakov was fighting. When Yaakov was fighting this so-called Malach of Esau, it's the representation of the Yitzhara. He says, what is your name? Is your name atheism? Is your name socialism? Is your name liberalism? Is your name communism? What's your name? Right? So, what does the Malach answer him? Why do you ask my name? So, we have no shame kavua. It all depends on the time. Lama zetisha al shmi. Don't ask. Why are you asking what my name is right now? My name is constantly changing. Depending on what the nisayon of the door is, that is what my name is. That's the form the Yetzirah comes in. And Rav Shinshin David Pincus says, so what's the Yetzirah of our generation? He says, the Yetzirah of our generation is being not busy and seeking fun. He says, in Hebrew, what's the Hebrew word for fun? Kef. Wrong. Kef is an Arabic word. There's no Hebrew word. We took the word because we don't have that word. Because Lashon HaKodesh doesn't have a word for fun. So we went to our neighbors and we borrow a word from you. So we took the word kaf from them. And there's no concept of Judaism as a movement of seeking fun. If you go out to the world, okay, and most of us, including myself, we don't realize to what degree we're mired in seeking fun. Now, I'm not telling you, I'm telling you a caveat right now. I'm not telling you that right now everyone has to walk out of here and you have two options. You get a job, right? In other words, you know, there'll be a break now, so either learn during the break or ask Mr. Naiman what you can do. It would be a nice thing to do once in a while to offer him some help, right? Obviously, we need a break, etc. We need a break from work. We need a break from learning as well, because that's our mind sometimes needed. To whatever degree you can minimize that, we're better off. I can't imagine that the real millionaires out there, okay, even out, going to outside the Torah world as a model, really engage in fun as much as they really try to osek in their parnasa and their business all the time, trying to go from 1 million to 10 million, etc. Okay, but the biggest threat that Rav Shinshin David Pincus says that we have is our desire to seek fun as an end goal. Okay, Goyim out there, and many Jews out there as well, are constantly looking for the next thing that's going to be pleasurable in life, the next relaxation. If you go to the real world, you'll see, your secretaries, etc., always talking about how they're going on my cruise. I'm going on to, they have this thing when you go on the cruise, and it's the greatest thing. I'm sure some of you have been on cruises as well also, but and it could be in a nice way, it could be a total cruise, etc., but the way they look at it, they look forward to this from one cruise to the next. They're always looking forward to this cruise, okay? And it's like the highlight of their life, and everything they're doing right now, they're working to save up, everything they're doing is not for any purpose except for the next fun thing in life, for the next pleasure. That Rosh Hashanah Pekah says is the greatest nisayon that we have in our generation, to realize that fun is not a Jewish concept. Okay, we can have relaxation, we can, and the purpose of relaxation is so you can work more, so you can do more productive things, but there's no goal on its own to have fun. I've never seen a source in Judaism that would argue that fun is, or even in the outside world, fun is never important innately. It's only the byproduct of hopefully an experience that was relaxing to you, that recharged you, so you can go on to the next matter at hand, be it work or be it Torah learning. In fact, this threat that I'm describing here, that a person who is not working and is batel, the Mishnah actually says it in Farish, in Maseches Ksuvos. The Mishnah over there describes the jobs that a woman would have to do for her husband. It says, Eilu melachos she'aisha osa labala. She's tochenes, ofer, she grinds the wheat, she bakes it, mechabesa, she does laundry, mevashal, she cooks, umenikas benan, she nurses her children, that matzas lo asamita, she has to make a bed, etc. It gives a whole bunch of jobs over here. Now let's say she brings into marriage a shivcha. She brings in someone to cover some of her work. So the Gemara starts with the more shvachos that she brings into the marriage, the more she has to do less work. Let's say she brings in enough shivchos, so she doesn't have to do any work at all. And now Rabbi Elazar says, Afilu hichnisa lo mea shvachos, kofilasos betzemer. You make her do something. Why? Shabbatala mevia lidezima. Because if you waste your time and you don't do anything, sin is that vacuum of non-production, sin is going to fill the void. Sin always fills the void. Now, what? So why not just learn Torah all day? Why not go to that side? Okay. Now, halavai that we could be productive like that. But what could happen? What's the threat? Why don't we say that all of us should get up right now and go sit and learn all day and forget college and forget trying to find a job? So the Rebbein Yonah tells you that there's something to the other side as well. Kol Torah she'eini ma malacha sofa batala. If you don't have malacha with your Torah, it's not going to work. Okay, it says ein kemach ein Torah. Without bread, Torah is not going to happen. And it's goreres avon. That's how the Mishnah continues. It causes sin to continue to flow. Zeh avon hu shehabitul mi malacha. When you're mevata malacha, you come to poverty. Okay, the goreres kama avonos. So there's two properties that work brings to the table. We focus so far that work, in combination with Torah, fills your life, fills the time of your life. So you're busy, and this heart doesn't bother you. But work brings on something else, and that is that work helps you bring in an income. Okay, and if you don't have work, so you're going to have poverty. The Gemara is kama avonos, the rasa rabba. Anius has a tremendous amount of averus that come together with it. A person who's poor is a great risk for sin as well. Ki mipanel yahav matanos. Person know that says in Mishlei sone matanos yichya. Person who hates gifts will live longer. But if a person's poor, he's going to count on gifts. He's going to go over ask for gifts. Person who goes and asks for sukkah, he's involved with the problem of sone matanos yichya. And what's going to be? He's also going to find himself doing the isser of chanufa. He's going to flatter people, so hopefully to help mefarnes him, support him. Okay, even if they're rishayim, and you're not allowed to flatter people who are rishayim. Gam ki yitam hakesef me'amatanos yeganav. And then what's going to happen? Let's say the money dries up, no one's giving him gifts anymore. He's got to feed his children. They're screaming for bread. So the next step is he's going to steal. The next step he's going to steal, or he's going to viavo gizelas ha'ani lebeso leval yamos barav. He's claiming I'm an ones. What am I supposed to do? So he goes out there and he steals to support himself. That's because a person is not going to let his kids starve. So obviously we're supposed to be wise and in advance, okay, come up with some kind of a skill. And we know the chachamim, the chazal, all of them worked. In chazal we see numerous examples. I left it at home, but that one of my Maror Mekomos was the Sefer Baruch Shama written by Rav Epstein, the Sefer Tamima, and he brings down a huge list of what the Tanaim and Amoraim all did. All of them worked, and yet they were the Balei Masorah. The Rambam, in fact, brings down in Hilchos Talmud Torah, those you probably many of you have seen it before, that in Hilchos Talmud Torah it says that that from Har Chazal, many of them were Chot Ve'etzim. We know Hillel, the first 40 years of his life, Hillel was a Chot, it was someone who chopped wood. He took some of the money and he tried to pay off the Shomer in the Beis HaMedrash, and he worked with it. Shammai, we know from the Gemara in Shabbos, where he hits the ger with the, he chases out the ger with an Amah HaBinyan. Seems he was a contractor. Okay, we know that Rabbi Yoshua from the story in Brachos, right, from Mikotle Beisecha, Nikar Shepechaniyata, from the walls of your building, we see you must be some kind of a blacksmith. Constantly throughout Shas, all the stories in Maseches Tainis, so many of the Amoraim had jobs that they busied themselves with. The biggest tzaddik, who was one of the biggest tzaddikim, okay, in Maseches Tainis, is Abba Umna, who was every single day, I think, was zocha to a gilui of Eliyahu. Okay, and what did he do? He was a doctor, and he had so many opportunities for chesed, and described the chesed that he did. But so many of the Tanaim worked and produced because the risk of the sins that come along with anios, of having to rely on people. How many people will go into debt, okay, borrowing from gemachin, borrowing from banks, and they have no choice. Again, the kids are hungry, they go there, and they say, I'll worry about how I'm going to pay it back later. And then their whole life, they have no plan, and they have no way of figuring it out, and just working from loan to loan. It's not a mahalach, and that's the problem of a person who would learn all day without having any chance of support. He's involving himself in some very, very serious averus. So on one hand work has the function, okay, that it protects you from sin just by keeping you busy, and work also helps support you. And that's why it says yigia kapecha kitochal, person who's the toil of his hands causes him to eat. Ashrecha v'tov lach. It's ashrecha b'olam hazeh, and it's tov lach l'olam haba. In this world, it's good. You have a way of avoiding sin by keeping yourself busy. Okay, busy with your hands. I chose dentistry myself because I loved working with my hands. My hands are always busy, obviously, when you're a dentist. Okay, so it's ashrecha b'olam hazeh. Okay, because you have the benefit of keeping you busy and your harnasa, and it's tov lach l'olam haba when you come to the next world and all that time that you worked wasn't filled with sin. So that's one side. That's one side of the equation. On the other hand, you can't forget Talmud Torah, and the Chachmas Adam in his introduction. The Chachmas Adam was Avram Danzig, so he was, I think, a banker. I think he was a salesman. So he writes in his introduction, like, who am I to write this sefer? After all, many of you recognize me from the shuk that I would go into in Lipsing. Okay, there was some kind of a fair, and he was always there. He was selling his goods. So he describes what he would do. He said, whenever I went to the shuk, I always carried with me my svarim, and I always learned during the shuk. And I really was always yelling at all the people who would come to the shuk and say, once you're involved in this, once you're involved with the shuk, you can shut down your business of Torah. Now is the time for business. So the person is always supposed to be koveya itim Torah. And he quotes a pasuk from Iyov. The pasuk in Iyov. Let me see if I have it. It says like this: Tehom Amar. Lo bihi yam amar eini madi. Tehom, shows a great vast body of water, says it's not in me. Okay, lo bihi, and the yam, the water, says eini madi. So what's the pshat in this pasuk? Yov. So it says like this. Chazal actually learned from this pasuk that you're not going to find Torah among business people. Very profound statement, scary statement. Okay, you're not going to find the Torah among business people. And he says like this. What's the pshat? There are two kinds of business people. There's a person whose business completely consumes him. That person is called Tehom. It's like a giant water where you can't even see the end of the water. It's so huge. That's because this person is constantly involved in business. He's always trying to make a deal. The entire focus of his life is completely consumed to the point. Baruch Hashem, he's a busy guy. But he's so busy, he has no time for anything else. No time for his Torah or his family or anything like that. So if you would go over, right, to a person who's like that, so let me backtrack for a second. If you have a person who's an usher, okay, a really rich person, and you go over to that person and you say, I need a loan. But the person right now doesn't have any cash on hand. He says, what does he say? He says, Eini Madi, it's not with me right now. I don't have the money on me right now. Right now, I'm not liquid, okay, I might even have a cash flow problem, but in a week I'll get back to you. But if you go over to an ani and you ask him for the same loan, the person's going to say what? Lo bihi, it's not me. So he says, that's the same thing. A person who is a businessman, who's always osek in his business, who's totally consumed by his business, okay, with nothing else in the world that's on his mind, that's a person who's going to say, you got the wrong guy. If you ask him a pshat in Torah, or a chiddush in Torah, or something, he's going to say, sorry, you got the wrong guy. It's not me. But let's say you go over to a person who's not consumed with his business. He's like a yam. Sometimes he's busy. Sometimes he's involved in his business. Other times he dedicates to learning Torah. So right now, when he's busy, let's say during a peak season, it's accounting season, it's April 15th, etc., he might not be able to kovea the same itim of Torah that he usually would do. Right? So he's a person who's going to say, Eini Madi, sorry, the Torah's not with me now. I'm going to return to the Torah. But there's a very big distinction between a person who's married to his job and is consumed by his job. He's a person who the Torah is not with him at all. Okay, but a person who sometimes is busy, right now you might catch him at a wrong minute. You might catch him at a minute where he's not learning. That's a person who would say, lo bihi. It's not with me right now. So he went on to describe at the end how this was his mahalach, and he wrote this Chachmas Adam. He eventually went on to become one of the biggest poskim. Chachmas Adam is quoted in many from all the time. I'd like to finish with an idea of balance, how a person balances, from a story from Rav Huttner. This is in the letters in the back of the last volume, Igros and Kesavim of Rav Huttner. So Rav Huttner there was told by his student, right, that I feel very, very torn. This balance of trying to find the right amount of time for Torah, okay, and the right amount of time for work is very, very hard for him. When he was in yeshiva, he felt he was always involved in ruchnias. But when you're at work, even though we're telling you that it's a big part of your Avodas Hashem, the whole point of what I was discussing now is to realize that Avoda is a very important part of your Avodas Hashem. Okay? Malacha is a part of your Avodas Hashem. The student couldn't deal with it, and he felt like he was living a dual life. Okay? So Rav Huttner wrote back to him and said, no, that you're working and learning now is not a dual life. He said that what that's called is called a broad life. It actually writes these words in English in a Hebrew letter. So it's not a double life, it's a broad life. A person who has a house in one place and has with a family there and a family in another place, he's living sort of a double life. But a person who just has a big house, okay, and just expands his house and doubles the size of it, that's not a person who's living a double life. Before you were just learning, now you're learning and you're working, and that, he says, is a broad life. Okay, he quotes the pasuk that he quotes a line in Chazal that says, "Kol marichin be'echad, marichin lo yom avushnosav." Right, we say echad right at the end of Shema, and you're supposed to say it as long as possible. Right, it's hard to do, and you echad, right, so you're supposed to do that. So, what's the pshat in that? That there's echad, but your echad could be broader. And once you include work and learning, you're broadening your outlook, and it's still achad. Shem is still achad, but you're spending more time, you're focusing more on it, etc. This is all part of your avodas Hashem. So you have to realize that all of what I'm saying right now is all extremely nogea to you within a week from now if you're working, and especially if you're not working. Okay, we have to realize the whole hashkafa of Judaism when it comes to work. But what it comes is, we must fill our times. There can't be voids in our times. When we go ahead and we kill hours on Facebook, that's not work and it's not learning. We kill hours on all these things. And how often can you justify that in terms of, I need a break? Does your break have to be that long? That's the question. Because you know that that the more time you spend on it, the more chance you'll get involved with all sorts of Yisurim of Lashon Hara and sometimes other Yisurim as well. Okay? A person has only two things that he can do in life to keep himself as an Ovid Hashem. All of them involve keeping yourself busy. A person must keep himself busy. And you have to realize that lack of busyness is the greatest threat that you're going to encounter in this next 3 weeks. It's 4 weeks until you go to camp. And in camp also you have to make sure you're busy. But there's a very big looming threat ahead of us, and a person has to keep himself busy with mitzvos and with Torah, and you get a job with work as well. So that's the end of the Shir Klali part. I'd like to bring the panel up, okay? And we're going to go through, that was sort of the Ashkafic background. Now we're going to get to more practical examples of what it's like to combine. He's going to come. He likes to make a powerful entrance, an impactful entrance. This is where the moderator stands. I'm the moderator, but I'm one of those moderators that participates as well. I made the questions up that we're going to ask. If a person has a really good question, it's a good time, and it's an opportune moment, then feel free to ask the question. But generally, when you do these kind of panels without guided questions, they kind of just fizzle out, and the guys sort of make their way out slowly from the room. So the first thing we would like to do is tell us a little about yourself, about you're combining this tension of working and learning. How did you choose your profession? And tell us your names.
Sure. Hi, my name is Akiva Danto. Hello, Akiva.
Oh, wow.
So I work for a company called Johnson & Johnson. So you're now the shampoo bottle saying no more tears. So that's what I do. I take the shampoo and I rub it in my eyes. If it burns, I make them run it again. If it doesn't burn, I give a seal of approval. So actually, what I do is I work in something called clinical trials. The clinical trial is when they want to test out a drug to see if it works, they have to do a trial. And in order to do that, you need lots of contracts, thank God. And I negotiate those contracts. I fell into this particular role really purely siyata d'shmaya. I started off in doing something called healthcare management, which, if you remember Sesame Street, I want to be involved in healthcare, and I like management. Healthcare management, I put them together, and I came out with healthcare management. One of the reasons why I wanted healthcare management is, again, I like the aspect of helping people, and I like the challenges of management, so I put the two together. And I think the final reason why I chose that profession is I did some research, and I wanted a job that did not predominate my life, did not take over my life. I did not want a job where my life became a 9-to-5. I want to have a career that would allow me to work kavua hours, 9-to-5, so I could have a life, a productive life, 5-to-9, yet still put food on the table. So that's how, that's my name. I covered, I got my profession and how I came to it.
Over to you.
Next. Okay. I think the one thing I can beat Akiva on is my name.
And
Mitch
height.
Mitch Rich. Aside from that, he's got everything else in his job. What I do is I work for a company. We do real estate software implementation. If anyone had ever asked me if I would be doing that when I grow up, I wouldn't even know what it was, nor would I necessarily been interested in it. I actually, when I was finished in college, the big thing was startup and dot-coms. I went to work for a dot-com. I think I'd be a millionaire by the time I was 22. It didn't exactly happen. Then there was a dot-bust. I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember that, but basically everyone, people were making a lot of money in startup, and then it stopped. So after that, I decided I had enough of business and I wanted to go into chinuch. So I taught for a couple years in high school, Limurei Kodesh. And then the company that I also very much see out to Yishmaya, the school that I was teaching at, someone here from Kushner? Kushner in Livingston? Okay, so I was teaching there. Limurei Kodesh, and the school is, I wouldn't say owned, at the time it was kind of owned by the Kushner family who was in real estate. And I said, I was trying to do some business. So I said, let me go over there and see if they needed anything. They needed somebody in computers, so I said, oh, I know how to use a computer, and they hired me there in the summer, and I went to work there trying to also combine teaching Limurei Kodesh in the morning and working there in the afternoon, which I thought was going to also be a great solution, and if it can work out for somebody, I think it is, but then the owner of the company move on to greener pastures, and I moved on to doing other things there. Not combining teaching and learning, rather trying to find something as well, which I could compartmentalize my time, spending what I thought would be 9-to-5 working in software, real estate software, something which I had experience in by that time. And it was also a good track. We'd always wanted to try to get there. So And this was a good track to do that, something where I could spend time doing that, something I thought I could do remote. So that's how I ended up in this field of working on real estate software implementation. And what we do is we take, we work with a software package, we implement it, we set it up for companies, we help them support it, we do customization of reports, we help them with their charts of accounts. A lot of Jews in real estate, so I can network that way. And Baruch Hashem, so far it's working out pretty well.
Hi, my name is Daniel Hartstein. And I guess I'm the most dishonest person on the panel because I currently am not in the business world, or at least that the yeshiva is aware of. my profession until about 3 months ago was telecommunications. I went to a college maybe you never heard of, Yeshiva University, and I did marketing there. Marketing and management. The reason I did that was honestly because I wanted to learn more, and it was a very good learning major.
She was in economics.
What?
Economics. Is
it was a harder.
It was harder.
I wanted to go into. I actually thought I was going to go into advertising. I had liked that. I was a people person, and I wanted to do that. And then, as great luck would have it, the year I graduated YU. The government of Israel had a little incident where somebody was accused of bribery and put in jail, and the Ministry of Defense of Israel, which receives $4 billion from the United States, all that money has to be spent in the United States. The United States says, we are going to stop giving you the money unless you hire American citizens. So I was an American citizen at the time, until it was revoked last year, but I was an American citizen, and so the Israelis, in their smart thinking, said, well, who are we going to find that cares about Israel and cares about, you know, and as an American citizen, and that was YU. So they came to us and we interviewed a lot of people. For some odd reason, I was chosen, and I sold weapons for the first 3.5 years of my life after college. I bought weapons for the Israeli government and different other types of things I can't talk about. And then it was time to leave because they were paying me 3% a year in a raise, and I was not able to support a family. I had just gotten married, so I went into telecommunications. For about 15 years, that's what I've been doing, buying and selling of minutes, a little bit boring, but being in sales. Most recently, before Rav Boaz Chapmi, I started a company with some investors in certain towns in that have five of them. And I was in telecommunication. Basically, I headed a company doing sales, having employees and managing them. And through my life, I've basically been in a manager type of position probably in the last 10 years dealing with employees. Interesting. Did anybody discuss the learning part? Is that part of the question?
Yes, I was
hoping to get it.
Oh, I apologize. I just wanted to point out my entire life. So I wanted, obviously, learning to be an important part. So quite honestly, the profession that I chose, I think I would have been very capable in doing some of the other professions that some of my friends went into, who came home every night at 11 o'clock and never saw their families. That's something from when I started I did not want to do. I wanted to be able to make learning a central part, which certainly affected, at the end of the day, how much money I made. There's no question about that. Baruch Hashem, I think, until I made Aliyah, I think I was pretty financially successful. I'm being honest, but learning was always an extremely important part. So that was always part of my life, even if, certainly when I made Aliyah and Rav Boaz again caught me up to be learning, with the boys at night. So that was something that I wanted to do because I wanted to keep learning going. I found in my own personal life that, thank God, while I was actually working, I went for smicha. I had some difficult years. I had a smicha. I was going for a master's in engineering at the same time. It was not easy. But that allowed me to keep up the learning, because when I had a goal, so I kept doing that, and then right after that, I kept teaching, I kept giving a shiur. So I found that there was always learning was an integral part, Baruch Hashem, of my life.
So I always like to address that. I assume I was going to second round with that. So in terms of the learning and the way learning plays a part in your day, that was also something which, when I was choosing my profession, I also felt, just like what Hartstein said, in terms of being able to. I was looking at different things like law school, etc., and I saw and looked at my friends and my parents' friends and the kinds of hours they were working in different professions, and I felt that I was not going to be able to sustain serious learning in doing that. The other thing that I felt was that at night was not the time that I did my best learning, at that time at least, and I looked for a profession which would allow me to have a flexible schedule. So for the first number of years that I was doing this. At the beginning, I mentioned I was teaching in the morning, and then I started basically, I was able to work from home a lot in this field, so I would usually have a chavrusa from like 8:30 in the morning till about 10, and then start the workday. So that was definitely something which was important to me as well, and also the idea of setting goals and always trying to be part of a program or part of either giving shiurim or attending. Thought that was something which was also important in the field that you choose. And there are a lot of fields, even in the field that I'm in, and I find that this is so today more, it's creeping into a lot of fields. It's very hard to try to set boundaries, especially with the way things are today, at least from my own experience with being connected 24/6 and people reaching out to you. That's one thing about being in a different time zone that's kind of nice, which is that you have this gap in the morning, because otherwise, like, the people that I work with are on at night, you know, after they put their kids to sleep, they're back on at work. So I find that that's something challenging and that really need to always be cognizant of and working on breaking out that time. Beyond that, just in terms of, is it appropriate time to also talk about what you...
Let's just move on to the questions. Okay, let's talk about moving away from working and learning, that issue, just in terms of what threats to your spirituality, your ruchnius, have you found in your careers? Whether it's a threat that's part and parcel of what you're what you do, I'm talking about any kind of threat that you felt was a challenge and how you dealt with it. We'll start with
you. Sure. I thought about this question a lot, and I think in really three categories that I could picture, two of them which were not no good to me, and I'll talk about the third that is. The first one is the abject anti-Semitism that my parents and my grandparents might have had in the work field. That, Baruch Hashem, doesn't exist anymore, for better or for worse. The second is I was not exposed to this, friends of mine were, where the level of preachers at the workplace and we're going to strip clubs is a normal course of action during the day. There are areas and fields where this occurs. I was not exposed to that either. The part that I think I do find to be a threat spiritually, and this is almost ironic, is the lack of differentiation between you and your colleagues. When you go to work, you're working with people that look, act, dress, and otherwise are perfectly like you. These people are ethical, these people are moral, they're family people. And you look at them, you look at yourself, and you don't necessarily see anything of distinction. That, to me, in my mind, is a very significant threat. Because the slope coming away from that familiarity is very, very steep. Because if you begin to look at it, there's a guy at work, Peter Mays, he's a great guy. And I got along with him well at work. The slope of having that connection, of having that personal relationship with him is very scary, because having going to his house for the weekend to have a barbecue is a hop, skip, and a jump away from the relationship we had at work. That's very real. That's very threatening.
So you didn't go to the barbecues?
I didn't go to the barbecues.
What was wrong with the barbecues?
Obviously, right, he was veggie burgers, which I hate, but it's the... because the threat, as I call it, is very innocuous and makes the threat that much more stark. When you begin to think there's nothing wrong with having an intimate relationship with a non-Jewish employee, co-worker. There's nothing wrong with hanging out with them during the weekends. And then, I think as you spend more time with them, you start realizing beneath the surface that there are very stark and real distinctions between you and your non-Jewish colleagues. So, for example, when we come home at night, we have an obligation to learn. They don't. When they come home at night, they veg out in front of the television. So when you come back to work the next day and you see, here's a perfectly ethical, normal, great guy. He spent last night watching American Idol, watching this, watching that. Why can't I do the same thing? The net sum is the same thing. He's a great working stiff. I'm a nice working stiff. Why do I have to have these other things that distinguish me from him? That threat, I think, was the most real. So I put a very strong barrier in terms of myself. A lot of times when... folks were leaving, they would set up happy hour and they would not even invite me, and I'd like to think. And actually they stopped asking me, I should say it that way, because I never went. It was never a question that there are not between 9 to 5, I'm friends with you, I'm cordial with you, I speak with you, but once 5 o'clock comes and they blow the whistle and I slide down the back of the dinosaur like Fred Flintstone, I'm done. And I'm going home to my family, I'm going home to my chavrusas, I'm going home to my real life. And that barrier is something that was very real for me, and it really, really pushed the envelope for me to make sure that when I came home at night, I had a meaningful rest of my day, and I did not have a droll, you know, uneventful TV watching, beer swilling rest of my day, even though on the surface it seems like my coworkers were doing the same thing I was doing and were the same person I was, but in reality I wanted to keep that distinction sharp. So I think that familiarity and that lack of anything threatening and the lack of pretzus, that talk was probably the most threatening part of it.
I'd say that I'm a bit envious of Akiva's position where he's able to do that and say after five, no. I think that depending on what types of fields you're in, I think that's a very admirable thing to be able to do. I think in various fields today, it's very difficult because the line between work and personal life gets blurred more and more. You know, I'll be at a conference. Again, it's up to the particular field, but people will be at a conference or you'll be working late and they'll be ordering dinner or something like that, and you'll be in a situation where you really do need to work on those boundaries. And it's more difficult than just saying after five, you know, I'm not there. And I think that that's probably one of my biggest challenges as well, is dealing with that and setting up those boundaries. I find also the nivel peh and just the words that people use, like it's nothing, the cursing and the pointing out, you know, you're walking down the street with a couple of colleagues heading to a meeting and they'll start pointing out the various sites in the streets of New York City that you might enjoy perusal of. It's just completely normal, and everybody's just like, that's the way it is. So I think that absolutely setting up those boundaries is very important, and letting them know that you're different in whatever way possible. My colleagues do know that I'm different. They know, you know, that I can't eat what they eat, and that Shabbos is Shabbos, and that, you know, I don't drink. I think that's actually one more point. Rav Willard talks about it a lot, but I think the importance of not drinking with colleagues. I was just at a conference last week, and they all, the most senior executives, they just seem to be drinking a lot, especially at these conferences, and it's so, so important. If there's one message to take home, that it's like there are alcoholics that now they're recovering alcoholics, they don't drink no matter what. That's how I think you have to have that rule, that no matter what, you don't drink with your colleagues, because that's a rule that's going to be broken. And those boundaries, very important, but I think everyone has to find what they are and speak to a rav and try to determine where you need to set those boundaries for yourself, because I think those
you
are really important.
You find that, as you said, you can also answer this question, that as you set those boundaries, when it became clear, this is who I am, and you know, I offer a lot to my employer, do you find that some of the pressures have come down, what their expectations were in terms of socialization? Also, in terms of, I found that in terms of nivel peh, for example, I know when I walk into the room, in at least one of my offices where I work, in a very gaudish office in Denville, New Jersey, very nice office in Denville, New Jersey, so they alter their speech. When I come in, they'll talk differently. And it's not that we're not buddy-buddy, we are buddy-buddy, but they do talk different. They know not to bring up certain subjects, etc. Do you find that setting those boundaries
helps? I've had people apologize. When they curse in front of me, I've had them apologize to me. And to me, it was so gratifying because it meant that I succeeded. It meant that they recognized my ears were different than their ears, so I had greater sensitivity. And it happened only a couple of times, but when it did happen, I felt very prideful and great about myself that they felt the need to apologize to me. And if they were talking about new topics, they did adjust their speech pattern when I came by. And like I said before, you know, they didn't invite me, and I felt great about it because, you know, when they didn't invite me, there's one or two possibilities. So they actually went out of their way to say, we were having one, but we know you don't want to come. So, you know, just here's where it is, but we won't be insulted if you don't come because we know that you don't go to these things. So I felt good that they actually liked me enough to tell me about it, and then that they respect me enough, and I guess they did good enough of a job of putting up the boundaries that they made sure that they knew that I wasn't coming to these things.
Do you have an issue with holiday parties or anything you work?
Think I've been lucky in many of the jobs that I've worked in. From the actual office standpoint, I've worked for predominantly Jewish companies, even some of them religious companies.
Is that something you was a goal of yours?
I think it worked that way. Once I started, one of my first telecommunications jobs was with Netophone. So once you get in that Jew mode, that's IDT. So once you get there and there's a base medrash and there's kosher food, that's how they get you, and then why they don't pay you a lot, because they're like, it's comfortable here. I'm being serious, it's comfortable here. That being said, there's, I think, even more of a challenge in some ways. Maybe it's just because of my good looks, but there were women that I found that because that you're so closed and you make it as a point, and I would extra, you know, put extra icing on this and say, I'm a rabbi also, so you really can't talk. They found that more as a challenge. And I found that there were some women who were overly trying to work on it, especially on business trips and the like. Where I had more challenges was where I didn't have the daily, meaning when I had to go to other holiday parties or other parties of other companies that I was representing my company, or I was a consultant I was representing. So there I haven't told my whole story to them because, you know, it never comes up. And then it became a very difficult situation, especially when you're in your own office, so you can get out of different types of, because you're not losing business. But when you're potentially losing business by insulting somebody and not going to the holiday party, which they're going to have kosher food, so why won't you come? Because everything now is kosher, because we have, you know, kosher food. And there's a mezuzah, don't worry, you know, something along those lines. That I think is even more of a challenge, because it becomes a challenge with your boss, who doesn't understand, even if he's from, by the way, why you wouldn't do this. And what goes on there as far as drinking and as far as, you know, everything that's been mentioned now. I found that more as a challenge because you're potentially losing business, and that's definitely much more of a challenge.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that it's when you're in a mode of representing your company or you're consulting, you're selling your services or your software, or you're a lawyer and you're representing to a client and going to a client's party. I think that's where a lot of the challenges, and that's where drawing the lines are much trickier. That's why I say it's important to consult those that have done before in Rabbanim in terms of understanding what the halachic limits are. I find it particularly challenging where, again, I'm working in an environment where there are other people who are quote-unquote modern or whatever they are, and, oh, well, she shakes hands with men, so why won't you do this or what? It's that area gets very tricky. You know, I always made it a practice to leave in the summer. We didn't talk on this yet, but one, like on the Shabbos in the winter, I would try to leave by like 1:30. And people are leaving when Shabbos was at 4 o'clock. They would leave the office at 3 o'clock. And they're like, well, he's Jewish, he wears a yarmulke, why do you have that problem? So I think that, again, it's very important to be, know what your limits are, discuss it with Rabbanim and people, and understand, because you're going to be challenged out there, especially sometimes when you're in environments with other, quote, from people, because when they do something or they eat this, you know, I remember I was working at a company, and they're like, well, he can eat tuna salad, why can't you? I was like, I don't know, I can eat the tuna salad. Not my, you know, not what my rabbi says. So, you know, it gets very tricky, and that's why I think it's very important to know. I always talk to my wife about that. We just got to know what our red lines are, and you have to add up those red lines, and then, you know, those are things you can't cross. And sometimes it does mean giving up business. It's tricky. It's always tricky to do that. But one time I lost the deal, and I'm pretty sure the reason that I lost the deal was because I wasn't chummy with the people. I was trying, you know, I was trying to do it while not insulting them. But it was, there were men and women together, and it was just getting too organized. I said, you know what, I gotta head out for the night. And I'm pretty sure that there, you know, but that was worth it, because who knows what would happen if I hadn't. And I think there are sometimes red lines which you need to stand firm on.
Now, I always had the experience when my secretary's got a tattoo where the sun doesn't shine. So she insisted on showing it to everyone in the office, and she showed it also to another from doctor who works in the office, but she knew not to show it to me. It was like not even a havamina for her to show it to me, because that, you know, but the lines are very, very, very clear. That guy, because if the other fellow, if he wasn't quite so careful in the Vulpat, or wasn't quite so careful in making a raunchy joke for a while. So guess what? The next thing you do, you're now subjected to the next level. But if you set those boundaries, this is what you are. And again, you could still be, you know, great friends, you know, with them. But when it comes to partying or socializing, that you have to set very, very clear boundaries. But in terms of, you know, creating an environment and aura of pleasantness in the office, it's very, very easy to do. If you just and it's really what you're supposed to do, because first of all, you'll make more business that way. There's nothing wrong with it, and you can become a walking Kiddush Hashem. It should be that when you walk into your office, okay, it should be like a breath of fresh air. That's what it should be like. That should be the experience of you walking into your office for everybody in that office. It's what Hashem wants from you, and it's good for your parnasa as well. So you had a question.
I was going to say, how do you deal with the problems that you have with your bosses when you have a conflict and they don't understand what you're doing? How do you deal with that without even getting fired at the worst?
You have to understand, certainly working in America, there are laws, and we live in a society today. most recently, I would say certainly in the last number of years, bosses are trained, managers are trained what they're allowed to say and what they can't say. If there are religious reasons why you can't do something, and they push you on it, certainly if they fired you, they have a lawsuit in their hands. But even to raise it as an issue is against the law. You know, as a firm person and just as an individual, you should know what those laws are. Especially if you're in a management position, you should know what you're allowed to say to women, what you can, because you could be sued for it. Here in Israel, it's very similar. I'll give you an example. I'm currently, I haven't worked for the company in 3 years. I'm in a lawsuit with a woman who's suing the company they work for, but suing me as her boss for firing her because she came back from maternity leave. And the truth was, she's being fired because she was a horrible worker. She was before she was pregnant, and she was after she was pregnant. She just doesn't do anything. And I don't care. So I said that under testimony. But there, they paid me 1,000 shekels. Anyway, but okay, and they had a car for me. Whatever. But okay, it's fine. On free lunch. The point is that after that, we had a session where we went through to make sure. The difference there, by the way, was she taped every conversation that we had together, because Israeli law does not prohibit one party taping. It's admissible in court. In America, you're not allowed to do that, as I'm sure you guys know. And every conversation that we had, she would sit down and she would have a recorder on her. It's just her phone. I didn't know that. But it was a great Musar Haskil, because I thought to myself, wow, imagine if you're speaking to your employees and you just keep in your mind, because an Israeli can do that. I was always a recorder on. Sometimes you just say something stupid. Hey, your dress is really nice. You can get sued. I'm saying that. So on both sides, you should know that. But on the flip side also, I'm saying you have to be firm with the boss, who, you know, you want to do well in life, but he should also realize that they're, you know, that normally I've worked for very difficult bosses sometimes, especially when it came to religion. The first words I ever had actually told me when I walked into his office, his first words to me was, Daniel, ani sone datim. I hate religious people. And I was like, okay, what? No, that wasn't my boss. you do have to deal with some challenges, and sometimes your boss will say that, and you're not stupid enough. You're not going to tell on him because you want to do well in the company. But you know what Mitch said is correct. You have to have your red line, and you're not going to pass that no matter what. Even if that's how people fall into these holes, is because your boss says, "What do you mean you're not going to the holiday? What are you crazy?" And you said, "Well, you know, once you say well no, then you show up at the party, you know, and then you're in marriage counseling because of what happened at the party."
You have to realize that most bosses are out there to make money, and they're not really so interested in getting into philosophy, etc., with you. And most of the time, most of these issues, if you're valuable enough to the company, which you need to be, to any company that you work for, they're going to look right past these issues and look at the bottom line. What are you bringing to the company, and what are you not? And that's, again, if you're mostly normal and you're try to be a pretty gishmak guy, then none of these issues are really issues. They're embarrassed very often to go ahead and step on your rights. And I don't find that it goes to lawsuits or anything like that. Almost always it seems to work out, certainly in my field.
I say sometimes you want to almost overcompensate and try and be so good at what you do, and also so caring about the people that you work with. Like a lot of people that I work with know that I'll go the extra mile for them, and you know, if I need to cover for them or something, I'll do that. And also, just in terms of being really good, if you're making money for your company, in a lot of fields, if you're making money for your company, you're making them look good, then they're happy. But I will say this, that there was one time that I had a really tough boss, and that was just trying to make my life miserable. They didn't like the fact that I had these red lines, and that they wanted people to stay until 10 o'clock at night, and I left at 6. And in the end, I just said, you know, this is not a position for me. I had to move on. Because if your boss is really keen on, I can't speak, you know, sometimes you really need a parnasa, and there are only so many jobs out there. But if you have somebody that you work with that's trying to prove a point by making you stay late at work, I didn't even have work to do, but he wanted us to be there until 10 o'clock at night. That's not what I signed up for. So I'm saying there are those red lines sometimes, you know, and Baruch Hashem, there are other jobs out there.
That's not religious discrimination.
I wasn't talking about religious. I was saying a case where it's not a red line. But, you know, to me, if I'm staying at work till night, every 10 o'clock at night, I'm not learning, I'm not with my family, you know, that was a red line to me. It's not a red line for a lot of people. I'm saying a lot of people do stay till that time at night. But again, I think it's about, in general, unless the person has an issue, if you're making money for them, they're happy. And if you're not, then you can be doing whatever and they're not happy.
What challenge, please, just so we can move along. This very well matches this question. In other words, a lot of these issues come down to honestly, your bosses expect certain things from you. You're supposed to give them a certain amount of your time, your effort, and your focus. Okay, so what challenges have you encountered involving honesty and integrity at work? Were you ever asked to do something that was unethical, and how did you work through that? So,
So Johnson & Johnson has this thing called the Credo, which actually was written by a from Jew. So I did not come across a lot of ethical challenges at work when I was in the States. Now, in terms of integrity, I certainly have a challenge every day. That when I, because I work remotely, the number of hours I put in, there's no one standing over my shoulder knowing how much I necessarily work in every given day. So every day, no matter how strong the temptation is to come down and beat one-on-one, I know that I have a commitment to go to work that day and a commitment to put a full day's work, and that's a challenge that I have now that I didn't have a challenge then. But in terms of the day-to-day function, I did not have that many ethical or integral challenges.
I have a situation. I work in a similar position where we bill hours, we sell our time, we sell software. And one thing that I had one time when I was working on a project, and they said, you know, I had worked maybe 20 hours and the budget was 50 hours. And my boss said, well, just pad it, put in 50 hours, and, you know, they're happy to sign off on it anyway. And I didn't, and it caused some tension there. I find, though, that a lot of times just it's good business practice that if you're willing to lie, and people know that you're willing to lie, so then do they really trust you? So I just don't think when you're being asked to lie in general, it's a good policy to lie. Just from a business perspective, even from the Torah, forget about it. But from a business perspective, you know, it's just if you're known as a liar, so then I think that presents some challenges. So I really try my best. It is challenging, and I've asked Shabbos before, and Choshen Mishpat's not an area where we're necessarily so knowledgeable in general. But like we bill hours, so sometimes, you know, if you work for 4 hours and you know, you had coffee and you had lunch with them, you went to the bathroom, like, how honest you have to be. And that's, again, something you need to talk to Rabbanim about. But that's definitely something that I find a challenge with, where it's not, you know, saying no to lying, that's an easier one. You know you're lying, so either you're going to lie or you're not. But when it's something which is a little bit of a gray area, it's something that I struggle with, I think, like Akiva daily. You know, we just try to do our best and be as honest as we can. When you're proving hours for other people also, do you know that they really put in those hours? That's a tricky area, and something that I struggle with.
I think being a salesperson, so unfortunately, those issues come up all the time. Some of you guys maybe know some of my stories as far as people who try to pay me off. One famous story about Nuri Abdallah was a guy who gave me $10,000 to continue working with him, which I didn't accept, unfortunately. But no, I didn't know I was making Aliyah. But it is from a salesperson is a constant challenge. Besides the lying and the cheating and that's kind of the business that I was in, and one of the reasons why I'm working here in the yeshiva now is because I saw a growing concern that was what the entire business was about. What I mean by that, just as a form of example, is that in the business that I was in, it was known that you would lie a lot of times about, let's say, the amount of minutes you have. You're trying to sell, you know, you say, I have 1,000,000 minutes a day to India. And the true fact is you have 10,000 minutes a day. But you say that because you know you're going to get a better price. And when you start the business, so you only send 10,000 minutes, and then you try to get the minutes. That's push-it lying. There's no excuse for that. And everybody does it in the business. That's known. It's a very small example, but that's known. To a higher scale where it makes a lot of sense to you because is when somebody offers you something or somebody says to you, well, if you do this, I'll give you an American Express gift card and nobody will know about it because that's not trackable. Those type of things, in my, you know, they happen all the time. I think it's a lot about integrity. I think I was known in the business to just be no frills as far as I didn't do any of this. I definitely lost business over it because a lot of people were doing different things. But there are challenges, and I think one of the most important things, which maybe sounds surprising, is that not enough people ask rabbis questions. Number one, they assume that this might be also when it's not. You know, taking home an office pencil, you might never think of, but that's a question. Some rabbis might say it's fine, it's within the realm, people know. Those are very important shilohs, and I've heard from many shul rabbanim that they don't get these shilohs. They don't get a lot of these shilohs. They get shilohs about milk and meat and is Wrigley Spearmint gum kosher, but they don't get shilohs about work shilohs that come up all the time. Sometimes there are unique situations where these things are actually mutter, and you can do it in a certain way where it's okay. I mean, the end of that of the story with the commission is that I had the guy go into the office of the HR and say, listen, if you want to give me a commission, run it past the HR department. If they approve it, then great. And surprisingly, they allowed me to get a non-monetary gift. So he sent me a massage chair. But I think that was crazy. But listen, the HR approved it. My boss approved it. Shkoyach, I got the massage chair. It ended up blowing up, and it was from a guy from Saudi Arabia. So that was a little nerve-wracking. It did. It went on fire, and my wife thought it was, you know, anthrax or something. And anyway, but thank God. So yeah, it definitely is a challenge. When business, I think just in the sales business in general, it's just a known business that people are known to be not so honest.
Okay, the next question. In yeshiva, we're exposed to many inspirational people, like the Machlis, who do unbelievable chesed and aren't paid for it. If you're getting a paycheck for your work, could your job still be chesed? Is there chesed in your job? How do you view that? Or have you used your skills for chesed in other areas?
So in terms of myself, one of the conferences I went to, they talk about something called the Oz Principle. Put it real briefly, essentially, take something called restaurant trend, like Kosher Delight. Lots of restaurants worldwide. Well, not necessarily true, but something kosher has restaurants worldwide. Worldwide. So the theory is that if you ask the busboy, the waiter, the cook in the back, the cashier, the CEO, the chief of marketing, anyone, what's your job? In theory, they should all have the same job. My job is to make sure that we have $5 billion of revenue this year for this restaurant. The busboy does it by clearing the table as quickly as possible so the next person can sit down to a clean table. If he doesn't clean the table well, no one's going to come sit at a dirty table. Right? The waiter, if he doesn't bring the food well, the cook, if he doesn't spit in your food, everyone has their specific role that they need to do in order to achieve the goal of serving 3 million people daily. Being in the healthcare profession, I had the peace of mind knowing that what I do, again, is I help facilitate clinical trials. Clinical trials testing out drugs. I can rest my head at night knowing that when I put in my 8 hours a day, my time that I need during the day, I am, in a sense, helping people. If the contracts don't get out, if the contracts aren't executed in a timely fashion, we don't have researchers to research our product. We don't have trials. The trials won't get done, the publications won't get done, and the drugs won't go to market. Unless I fill my cog in that wheel, it could fall apart, it could get delayed. So the chesed that I look at is that because I think I'm in a profession that's geared to helping people, even though my day-to-day is all about negotiating terms in a contract, negotiating dollars that on its surface seems incredibly boring, which it is, and incredibly meaningless, which it is, but knowing that beneath the surface it has a connection to people, it has a downstream effect, because this Oz principle, learning that lesson is something that is a great value I've actually learned from work and took from work, and made me feel a lot better that, yeah, I could definitely say that without getting paid, which obviously would not be so good, but without the aspect of getting paid, the functional utility that I serve in negotiating these contracts, it certainly can be an act of chesed. So I think once you, with that mindset of taking the Oz principle, you could apply that as broadly as possible. So first of all, anything healthcare related or people related is automatically fair game for feeling that you're doing chesed. And I think even other industries, and I'll leave it to the other members of the panel to expand, because I don't think they're in healthcare, to see how the Oz principle could fit to help make a greater sense of fulfillment in their day-to-day function.
A similar thought, the concept of this pay it forward idea, where if you, how you deal with other people in your workplace really impacts their lives. I think that a lot of people that I work with, a number of people, I think that's what differentiates us somewhat. They don't really care. Kind of, they're there to make their money and then they move on. And while that is a big part of why we're working, at the same time, when you actually, I work with a lot of people on a daily basis, clients and people in different positions, and trying to make their lives better and make them look good. And if they're having problems and having a tough time, you know, talking to them and listening to them, I find that you really make a difference in people's lives. One guy that I work with, although he hasn't become from, has become much closer to Judaism. And I remember he told me that, unfortunately, one of his children he became a grandchild without becoming a father-in-law first. And his son was, I think, 17 at the time, and while we were working together, and it was really challenging. It was going to be a tough period, and I found it really gratifying that I was one of the people that he like spent like an hour. Plus, I got to bill him for it. It was pretty cool. I see he's my client, but it was he spent like an hour schmoozing, and you know the issues that I was facing. I feel like dealing with people and being there for people also plays a big part. A lot of people out there in the world, they just have so many issues, so many challenges, and a lot of people just don't have anyone that cares in their life. So if you can, you know, be a good person to them, it's also Makadosh Hashem at the same time, I believe. So I think that's very helpful. And also being a cog in the wheel. I remember thinking for a while that what I do is meaningless as well. And then after there was a big economic crisis, I think that for some reason they said it's over, but I remember 2008, that's when they were really talking about how, you know, there were major challenges in the financial markets in the U.S. and things were going bust. And said that, I realized that what we do, if any area of business stops, there are a lot of people. The dollar's weak, it's not good for anybody, especially those of us that are living here making money in dollars and trying to send it a check out. So your job is meaningful in two ways. Both you're helping people, but also by helping support an economy, which ultimately helps support Torah and everything going on here. Because when the economy's bad, yeshivos and everybody feels it as well.
Have your skills helped you with doing chesed in the community? Or they're not relevant?
What are you speaking about specifically?
Sales? I don't know.
No, I thought you had a shul in mind. So first of all, I actually don't share their view, unfortunately. When I worked for the Ministry of Defense, obviously I felt amazing about going home and literally saving the, you know, certainly the Jewish people, because being an American, they actually were able to write letters that made sense to the American government. You know, they requested weapons, for example. They wrote a letter that, like, I didn't know what it said. I said to them, I go, how did you pass the English exam? And my boss said to me, I cheated. You know, he wrote an English letter he would have sent to a very high official in the American government. I felt great about that. I felt great about, you know, saving money for the Israeli government and buying weapons for them. Since then, 15 years later, I really have done nothing. I've actually, think, done negative as far as dealing with Arabs and people who probably really hated me but never told me. When I was at Net2Phone, we actually were interviewed by the FBI because some of the bombers of 9/11 had Net2Phone accounts. So they asked us about that, and it was very riveting that we were helping out the wrong people. I guess I could have felt, hey, you know, this is voice over the internet, and that's the new wave of the future. People can call. I honestly never felt that way, and that's what kind of gave me the outlet that I knew that I need to do, you know, chesed. I think with my sales skills and that, I was able to be involved in different chesed projects outside of my work, and that was because I really felt that I was deficient in serving the greater community. But I do think that that's something that you should consider as well. If you have a job where you're till 11 o'clock at night, and chesed is not only something that women should be doing, but it's so often accredited, the women are the ones that are. I don't think that that's true, and it shouldn't be true. And it's hard. People, unfortunately, many times are involved, you know, on a board of a school or a shul, and they never show up to meetings because they're not really, that's not chesed. So it is a challenge because you try to be at work and maybe, you know, the chesed person will call you and say, we really need you, and you have to figure it out. But I think that's also part of it, to be involved in chesed out of the workplace.
I'd say the start now also is really important, because when you find time, like in the summer, if you have a summer job, I feel like myself, I set that pattern. Like, you know that you find time to do things like chesed now. So when you get older, it's much harder, but you've set yourself the foundation that you found the time to do it. I remember when I was a summer time was once doing something, and it led me today to be able to say, okay, you know, I don't have time, but I'll find time to do this driving or that different thing. And I think it can be easy, small things. It doesn't have to be big and glamorous always.
Baruch Hashem, I get to be involved in chesed. The dentists in the neighborhood have organized a free clinic for the poor people who qualify to serve free dentists through Laman Achai. You ever go to Laman Achai building, on Lachish, so there's actually a dental operatory there, and now we have like seven dentists. We have now two periodontists, me and Dr. Weichels, and two orthodontists, all giving free care to people in the neighborhood, and it's a great thing. And if you have the ability to organize something like that within your job, you know, there's so many jobs out there where you can take your talents and literally do chesed with them. I mean, it's unbelievable. Just this past Friday, I did two surgeries in the office. The patient would have to pay for it. First of all, they would never have been able to pay for it. But in the States, we would charge thousands and thousands of dollars for that surgery. They got it all for free, literally for free. So also, if you'd like to donate any money to a dental clinic, that's a nice dental clinic.
Just point out one thing.
Yeah.
It's very important. I just thought of this. I think it's very important. Hopefully everybody will agree. One of the highest forms of chesed is trying to help somebody find a job. And I think that that's an area that you, as people who are looking for jobs, and might be going to people, you might not recognize what they're doing and putting out for you and trying to find you a job. It is something that is not the easiest thing to ask for favors and say, hey, can you find him a job? But certainly when you become professionals yourself, getting a resume for somebody else and not just forgetting about it and passing it on. And just you mere passing it on because of your stature can mean all the difference, especially if it's your company. And it's a tremendous, tremendous chesed, and I can tell you firsthand, a lot of people are not involved in that. I'm not sure why. When I was looking for a job not so many months ago, I sent my resume out to a lot of people who I thought were my friends, and a lot of them did not respond and said, I can't help you, I can't. And it was it was the most surprising thing to me. Not even to try. I think it's a very, very high form of chesed.
You didn't send it to me.
They didn't think I'm successful enough. I only sent it to a kid.
Okay.
And now I work in yeshiva.
Okay, moving along. okay, Koveya Idin. All these topics we have so far, by the way, like remind all of you that these are all nugea to the summer jobs that you would have. Obviously, chesed is very obvious. So many of you are working in house, but if you're working in a regular camp, there's so many opportunities you have for chesed. Are you going to be tired in the morning? Are you really going to help that kid? Are you really going to work for your campers? Are you going to put in, you know, more than 100%? It's like the basic line what your camp expects from you. And then there's going the extra mile for every single kid who's under your care. So the chesed is obvious. Being honest in terms of the same thing. In other words, you know, how much work ethic you have, how much you deliver, you know, if you're getting paid. And I know even in HASC you get paid. So all of you have to really work on that. And in terms of risk of spirituality, etc., that's all present in summer camp and summer jobs as well. Now, Koveya Itzim LaTorah. So we obviously have some excellent role models here on our panel of people who are Koveya very serious hours, not just a little bit to be Yotzei, but really trying to grow and learning even years out of yeshiva. So, and when I grew up, I was never really exposed. I remember the first time I ever heard of Neisseder. It was one of my Rebbe's, actually, where I learned it, who lives up the hill. I saw him coming out of a shul. I said, oh, why are you coming out of a shul? So he said, I have Neisseder. It's like, it's not Pesach. I have Neisseder. So then he explains to me, oh, every night I go and learn afterwards. I was very impressed. So I didn't grow up with that. And then I came to Eretz Yisrael. It was like simple that I would have some kind of a Neisseder, a morning Seder, or learning. How do you guys manage not just doing, you know, your kvias itim, but actually growing and learning so many years out of Eretz Yisrael?
It's actually, I gave one chug, and I gave it, it so nice, I gave it twice this year. A chug on 7 habits of planning effective balabatim that we talked about this. It's way too long to give it over now, but I mentioned one aspect of it, which feeds off to others, and it takes about 2 minutes. So it's Sunday mornings. So let's say you're a good guy and you're a Koveitim, and every morning you get up 6 o'clock daf, 7 o'clock minion, 7:30 train, Monday, Wednesday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. Come Sunday morning, get up at 8 o'clock daf, 8:30 minion, and you go about your day the rest of the day. If you're able to get up 6 o'clock on Sunday morning, you're redefining what got you out of bed Monday to Friday. By getting out of bed 8 o'clock on the Sunday, you're saying, God, look, I'm a good guy. Before I go to work, I'm kovet, I have my morning seder, I have my shakras. It's kind of as a bypass to work, as a stop along work, I first go to my seder, and then I go to work. By doing so, and then getting up at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the ikka part of what's getting out of your day, what's getting up in the morning, is work. But if somehow, some way, you're able to inspire yourself, you're able to drive yourself to get up at 6 o'clock, even on a Sunday, you're demonstrating Hashem, if it weren't for me, I'd be learning. If it weren't for work, I'd be learning the whole time. I have responsibility, and I think there's great benefit and utility and the opportunity in terms of work. And I'm doing that, and I wanted it, and I thank God for that. And I have that buffer on Monday to Friday. But the real reason why I get out of bed every morning is to learn your Torah. And you're able to demonstrate that when you get out of bed, Sunday morning, the same time you do Monday to Friday. And the question, and I think this is really a lot of it's the approach. It's not so much how you want to make Torah a part of your life. Like I heard the end of Dr. Callis's presentation from a letter from a Putner. Torah is our lives. Torah is our lives, 24/7. We are Torah Jews every single day, every single minute, every single hour of every single day. Sometimes that's manifest in the workplace, but as the introduction to the letter that Dr. Callis read from Rav Hutner, it's Torah, Kol Torah She'eni Ma'amalacha Sof L'Teila. The Iker is Torah. It's not how do you make Torah part of your work. It's Torah is our Avodah. Torah is our Iker part of work. Now, a necessary complement to that, a necessary part of that is our Malacha. But I think when you have the mindset of how do I incorporate Torah as a part of my life? As though I have a checklist during the day, I have to go to work, I have to brush my teeth, I have to learn. Then you could obviously triage sometimes learning out. But if Torah is what drives you, and Torah is what gets you out of bed in the morning, and that ikar part, and everything else kind of revolves around that, then I think that's something that's always helped me and helped me start. I think the last part is an expectation to strive for excellence. That if the Torah is a unique gift that was given to us, it's chaval that I don't treat it special and don't excel in it. So I want to try to excel in the gift that's purely ours, purely the Jews. I want to take that gift and excel in it.
I'd say that one of the main keys is finding Torah that you connect with and finding a way that works for you. I think there isn't necessarily one set way, one set shear, one set time of day. For me, I know I need to get up earlier in the morning to do it, because if I wait till night, I'm just going to be out of energy. And I think that's a call for many people, that you know when you do your learning. Also, what type of learning you do. Everyone connects differently. Some people love the Daf Yomi, and I did that for a long time, and then it was time for something different. It was time I wanted to be learning B'yon with a Chavrusa. Another thing that I really find helpful to me is listening to Shirim online, listening to audio Shirim MP3s. There's so much Torah out there today. Amazing high-level stuff, enjoyable stuff that you can listen to from Shirim. I personally like YU Torah, but there's just so much out there that you can listen to and build into your day. I think that's also a very big cloud, that the amount of time that you just spend moving from place to place or standing online or doing things, you can also get in Torah that way. Not necessarily that's your serious Seder, but it's a way to build in Torah to your day. So I think finding something that you connect with, and that's really what works for me, finding the right type of Torah. Another point is just, again, I recommend this summer, I started learning on the bus when I was, I think it was actually in yeshiva the summer right after, and the summer after yeshiva I actually started listening to Shira on the treadmill. And to me, that's something that's kept with me to this day. I do Brach, I know it's a little odd one, but I do about an hour of Shira listening, reading on the treadmill a day, because I know I can't focus for that long anymore, and if I'm there doing it there, that will help me. So again, that's not to replace necessarily time in the base medrash, but it's something that works for you. I think it's really good if you could start this on right after yeshiva. I talked to my guys in the Chug about this, that right after yeshiva, you're leaving, so there's this opportunity, as I... three weeks of nothingness. If you spend that empty, so then you're already setting a precedent. I think it's really important, even if it's just 15 minutes after davening in the morning, or you're traveling into work if you have an internship or something, take that time, listen to a shiur, or read a pocket mishnah or something like that. You're building a foundation that's then something that you do. And I mean, for me, Baruch Hashem, it's been like, wow, 15 years since then, and I still, that same Seder that I had on the bus or on the treadmill, Baruch Hashem stayed with me to this day. And sometimes when things get really busy, that's a learning that sticks with you. You know, Baruch Hashem, if you're dating, getting married, kids, whoever, you know, Baruch Hashem, first child, it's like, oh my gosh, I have no time. But if you know that, you know what, every day after I daven, before I daven, I take 15 minutes, then that's Chok V'lo Yavor, and you know, you keep that with you.
Okay. No, that's actually pretty much the answer. That's going to be the last question.
So obviously I'm a bit more of a unique situation. I certainly much more envy the two people on the panel, because I think that their Kovei Itim is much more of a serious type of Kovei Itim, because I think what the Rabbanu Sholem wants is to really see how your life is defined. And if you're able to define your life and say, listen, I have an hour commute on my bus or the train, and that hour I'm not going to spend listening to music or sleeping or reading the paper, but I'm going to listen to Shir or do Daf Yomi, the Rabbanu Shalom realizes that that's really what's important to you. And to get into that mode is hugely important. And, you know, the times that I commuted, you know, I certainly tried to do that. But you see from, you know, people who are totally in the world of professionalism, so I'm just not a little bit unique in that I've always, you know, had shurim to give. I've always had stuff to always prepare. So I've had that motivation, always. But I think that's really the advice that they gave is really the best form of advice. If you don't start it now, you're just not going to do it. It's just same thing goes with minyan. Kovei itim leminyan, I think, is just as important. If you don't wake up in the morning and go to minyan in the morning, you've lost your day. You're not going to learn as well. You're not going to make brachos on food. All those things are going to fall just because in the morning you decide to sleep in an extra half hour. I think that's also very, very important. And when you get to the work world, you have to be at work at 8 o'clock in the morning, you have to daven at 6, it's not easy at all, especially when you could sleep for another 45 minutes. But that, I think, is also important. Obviously, you have to have a Seder, Yorei Gal Yavor. I'm a big fan of chavrusas, in that I personally don't love chavrusas, but whatever, for whatever reason. But I think chavrusas are important because then you have somebody really beating on you. When I first got married, I thought that was one of my biggest challenges. Because when you first get married, you feel like this obligation. You have to be with your wife all the time, right? Meaning you, I was at work for 9 hours, and now I came home, and it's 8 o'clock, so I have to spend the rest of the night with my wife. So if you don't have a chavrusa who's, you know, knocking down your door and saying, hey, you got to get out of the house. Trust me, I've been married 2 years already. This is the way it is. He's an expert. But that was very important to me, because and then my wife also felt like I was going to something. I had something to do. As opposed to people who just say, okay, so once a week I'll go to the rabbi's shir. And then she says, I understand you have to go to the rabbi's shir once a week. I had the schuss of giving a shir every week in Teaneck, and so many people would come to me and would say to me, oh my God, I wanted to come to your shir, rabbi, but my wife wouldn't let me. I was like, excuse me? What's wrong with you? What are you? You should call 1-800 number for that. Meaning, what do you mean your wife won't let you? Meaning, I appreciate the guy comes home exactly at the time. You know, it must be very, very difficult, but it's something that you have to set a standard for right now, that this is part of my life. And when you start dating, so you let that potential woman know, not on the first date, but that's something that is important in your life. I will say, my wife always tells me that one of the things that impressed her most about our first date, clearly was not what I was wearing, nor my looks, it was the fact that I gave a Dvar Torah. I didn't do it to impress her, to be honest with you. Maybe that's surprising. She also, by the way, didn't think I was funny at all. Still doesn't. To her, that showed that there was something important to me, that whatever the meal was, it had to be centered around that there was a Dvar Torah. And I think that that's something that, don't be embarrassed by it. That's what you do. And sometimes on a lunch break, a person will be able to chop some time. That's extremely important to know that your lunch break isn't just an hour of spending with your friends. Spend, you know, 10 minutes if you can, craft that time around. Actually, as funny as this sounds, I find one of my biggest challenges actually being here in the yeshiva. Because I get paid not to learn. I get paid to be in the yeshiva from a certain amount of time. And my biggest challenge is being in a place of Makom Torah where everybody has a chus to be able to learn, and I'm stuck upstairs in her office, which by the way has no air conditioning, and I'm stuck upstairs and I don't have the chus to be able to come to the basement and learn. And it's a little bit awkward because if I do come downstairs, you know, I might have a chavrusa or two. Sober, don't tell anybody. I feel a little bit bad because it really I'm work time. Baruch Hashem, I'm able to teach at nights, but that's a little bit of a challenge for me. How to chop time when I feel a little bit bad about it because I'm right here in the Beis Medrash, but I have to work. So that's been an interesting challenge.
So far, as you try to draw a distinction between him and the other fellows on the panel, but the truth is, if you look at the common denominator between everyone on the panel, it's that when they left yeshiva, this sort of absolute care where there's a primacy towards what are they doing, what are they doing for learning, how is learning going to impact on every single day, and just because the situation in their life changes, it radically changes from year to year, everything changes. Right now, you know, as busy as you think you are, you're not nearly as busy as you'll be in college, and you're nearly as busy in college as you'll be in graduate school, and then when you'll have kids, you'll be that much more busy, and then when you're married and then have kids, and you'll be that much more busy, and then when you're trying to balance that, and you're involved in the community, you realize the weight that our esteemed panelists have on their shoulders, all the myriad of things they're involved in. But if you look, the thing that they are so concerned about, that they're so obsessed with, is what's going to be with my learning. And the trick is to be tricky, to find tricks, and to be very crafty about opportunities and time that come up, and then you have a chance. You want to finish the show.
No, I don't know. First of all, I wanted you to finish the show, so I tried to get it before you said, so you could definitely sum up one point that I think it was expressed, and certainly thought, but not necessarily expressed, was the absolute, I believe the phrase was Yehered v'yavor v'chevra, and chavrusa, and surrounding. So I know some of the panelists for many, many years, and the common denominator in many of our conversations has always been the same theme. And if you think you can do it alone, you're mistaken. You know, you need, as good as you're feeling, as strong as your feeling might be of where you are and how serious learning is to you at this moment, if you don't surround yourself around like-minded people, it's all going to fall apart. Dr. Callis has not only inspired me to learn when we lived in Bergenfield together. He had a post-chakras shir that he organized from the yeshiva back in Teaneck, I had mentioned that shiur to someone in, who lived in West Hempstead, and he mentioned some, 5-10 years later, he said, you know, because of the comment you made to me, there's now a kavua seder every Friday night. Really, the credit goes to Dr. Callis. Unless you're around like-minded people who have similar goals, it's all going to fall apart. I had this chus, Rabbi Hartstein mentioned several times that he gives shiurim. He didn't mention that he also served KE or fried chicken at the at these shiur, so I, therefore I went. Therefore I went. And surrounding myself around Talmidei Chachamim is a tremendous... it's a need. One of the aspects
of... used to go to the shiur that was Talmud.
Well, you gave it to the Dalai. One of the aspects of there's a Lashon Hara shiur once, and one of the aspects of Lashon Hara is always be damikas chos. One aspect of being damikas chos is not only a nice thing to do, but if you are damikas chos for others, then memela it puts the pressure on you. If you assume that everyone is doing Torah, everyone is doing chesed, everyone's going to learning on time, that puts a tremendous amount of positive peer pressure on you because you want to keep up with everyone else. So one aspect which wanted to flush it out before Dr. Callis summed up was that one aspect we did not talk about, it's nogeh to kol be'idim, it's nogeh to being integrity, it's nogeh to spirituality, is you have to sit, make sure you surround yourself around like-minded chaver who have the same goals.
Right, that's an excellent way to end it. Yishu Chayach. Thank you to our panelists, and hopefully you guys got a tremendous amount out of that. If you want to come and ask questions, well, we'll be at lunch eating, so come, feel free to sit next to us, and